Actually, it was the turn of the decade. It was right around 1960, just before everything happened that changed this world. Max attended a conference out here in 1958. How many of you were born in 1958? A few of you here? Yeah. See, one or two. Well, Max was already attending conferences back in 1958, and so was I. And he had black hair then, and so did I. I remember, I'm not sure what year that was, Max, but I remember the spot. We were sitting out on the lawn out in front of the castle, and we were talking about our future. And both of us had been bitten by the discipleship bug. The idea of really seriously following Christ and the idea of helping other people follow Christ and the idea of spiritual generations where as you give your life to another person and teach that person how to live that life and how to pass it on, you'll have spiritual children. And that was heady stuff back there because verses like Isaiah 60:22, a little one shall become a thousand, a small one a strong nation. I, the Lord, will do it. And we had our lives in front of us and we look forward to seeing what God was going to do through our lives. And I really kind of felt like with this discipleship movement, with this vision that we had, why somehow or other the world would never quite be the same after we'd gone through it. And Max knew where he was headed. It was very clear, his call, to work with university students within the Baptist church. And so you can see that the guy has stuck to his calling, and he's still at it. And I think that's beautiful. And to see this crowd here, the fruit one more time of Max and Sandra's lives, that's very encouraging. And I was clear also as to what I wanted to do. We were, my wife and I, Marge and me, were thinking about some other country, going to some other country, missions. And so in 1963, we headed down to Brazil, began to work with university students, and spent 23 years of our lives there in Brazil. And it really has been an adventure. And I think that Max, I'm sure we haven't talked about this, but what has really happened has probably exceeded our expectations, haven't they? I know for me, they have far exceeded my expectations. As we set out to go to do things, we felt, well, God is going to be with us and God is going to bless us. And we would envision some of the things that he would do. But I would have to say that my expectations were way too low. And that God has done far more than we ever dreamed he would. So I recommend it. Follow Christ. What I'd like to do now, though, is get us into a discussion. It's going to take a little while for me to position the discussion. And I'm going to use a bunch of five-syllable words in the context of the discussion. And so you're going to need a dictionary to follow me. Could you gentlemen pass these out for me? Just get them around. You're not going to be able to follow this thing we're going to do here without having some words defined for yourselves. The thing that neither Max nor I expected at all, but which was just coming across the horizon, was a just a storm of change, a storm that really transformed society. You all heard, it was before your time, but you all heard about the 60s, and that decade really did change the American society. But it wasn't the 60s. The 60s didn't just happen out of nothing. The storm was really about 500 years in the brewing. And began really with the economic revolution of the 15th century, where things went from being agrarian and basically a barter system to and a feudal system to a monetary system, a money economy. Well, then, not too long after that, we had the Industrial Revolution, which pulled people out of the countryside and put them into the cities. And so you had urbanization. Not too long after that, or really simultaneous with that, you had what we call the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment really was a state of mind where people decided that with the scientific process, with reason, actually with reason, they could sort out the big questions in life, and so reason really became the guiding light for this society. Well, with the Enlightenment, you've got the scientific process, which basically says if you can, the only reliable source of truth are the things that you can verify, that you can weigh and measure, and so it was a rationalistic society. This interesting thing about this was they elevated reason to the place where it controlled everything and became totally irrational in the process. But all of these revolutions really brought a mixed bag. It brought affluence. People had money. There were people wealthy in ways that the average person was wealthy in ways that only kings were before that. There was, the urbanization. The bigger the city, the more anonymous you can be, the more you can hide in the crowd. And in the small towns, why, everybody knows what you're doing. In fact, I was talking to a guy Sunday, had dinner with him out in New York. And he was raised in a small town in Switzerland. And we were talking about this. And he says, yeah, he said, in my town, he says, everybody knew everybody. My uncle was my teacher in school. And so my dad always knew everything that I was doing. And he says, when I wanted to sin, I had to go to Zurich. And so, the system of belief that held people together kept the community together and kept a person in line. It didn't keep them from being sinners, but at least it kept them under some kind of control. And the technology, the information, the revolution that developed, the moving and the processing of information became a major thing. And so what we have as a result, you can look at this page, modernization is the effect of the scientific processes on modern civilization, the effect of the economic, industrial, technological, information revolutions. And so that's a mixed bag. It's a blessing in the sense that if you go to the doctor, there's such a thing as anesthesia. It's great to have systems of communication. You can pick up a telephone. You can get across town. You can go across the world. And all of this is a part of modernization. The next thing that happened, secularization. Ephesians 2:12, without God and without hope in the world. And so the notion here is that secular is the last three lines is a process by which religious ideas become less and less meaningful and religious institutions more and more marginal. And rationalism, it's the belief that if we can just use reason, we can pick our way to truth. We can find out just about anything we want through rationalism. Relativism. It's a belief that there really is no truth out there. I had a conversation with a neighbor when I first moved back from Brazil, and we were moving in the direction of spiritual things, and I said, well, if we're going to talk about this, we need to at least agree on some of our basic ideas. And I said, would you agree with me that somewhere, someplace, truth exists? And he says, of course not. And it was as if That was just a given, that truth really doesn't exist any place. And that is really the prevailing spirit of our day. And the problem is that this isn't just those guys out there who don't believe. This stuff is leaking into our churches as well. And it leaks into our minds. This is probably true of what goes on in your and my head on many occasions. It's because, you know, we're swimming in the same soup with the rest of society. And the church isn't a whole lot different from the world when it comes to the values we hold and even to our behavior, unfortunately. And so another word you need to understand is pluralism. It's an extension of options. Since there's no ultimate truth, no officially approved pattern of belief or conduct, religions become a range of optional choices. You know, I believe in God, and God helps me get through the night. Well, you believe in the great pumpkin. And you say, hey, the great pumpkin helps me, and I live perfectly happily with the great pumpkin, and so get off my back. Because whatever you believe, it's okay. Privatization, where whatever it is you believe, kind of keep it to yourself. And you can believe one thing, you can behave one way in your private life and behave another way in your public life, and there shouldn't be any crossover. I heard Barbara Walters last week interviewing Bob Packwood. And she asked him, in the light of all of the scandals that are going on around him, if he felt that he should resign. He says, no. He says, I think I can do a good job here in Washington. I know I'm a dirty old man, but I know my way around, that I can get good things done. And so there's this cleavage between what you are and what you can do. And that's a part of our society as well. Modernity is really the big word on this page. It's a state of mind. It's what all of these changes do to the way we think. And I've summarized it here on this transparency. We go back to our my friend there in Switzerland, and there was a set of beliefs in that village where he lived, okay? And those beliefs really controlled the village. And by your behavior reflecting those beliefs, you were an insider. You belonged in that village. And so those three things were the cohesive that held a person in place. His set of beliefs would control his behavior, and his behavior would reflect his beliefs. And the way you behave determines what your status is in a society, whether you belong or not. And so belonging and beliefs and behavior were all tied together. Now what's happened is this whole thing has fallen apart, and it leaves people shattered. Relativism. Whatever it is that you believe, it's okay. You know, I believe that there's no truth. You believe that there is truth. Well, keep your beliefs to yourself. I'll keep mine to myself. There is no such thing as absolutes. And pluralism, whatever you're into, it's okay. Just follow it. And then privatization, whatever you believe, keep it to yourself. And so these things have caused our society to disintegrate. And our beliefs become so tentative, they are not strong enough to bind us to others in community. We lose our capacity to belong. Because we don't belong, we have no accountability for our behavior. Our beliefs aren't strong enough to influence behavior either. So behavior goes out of control. People who live this way get hurt. Now, that's kind of a quick summary of where I think our society is headed. I think that you guys are moving into a society that is going to be very hard to live with. We're leaving you really kind of with a mess. And I'm sorry for that, but that's really is what is happening. And I think that as a result of the disintegration just of our belief system, Everyday life is also disintegrating. And it's disintegrating for several reasons. One, we really don't have anything that holds us together in our concepts. But also, with modernity, what's happening is that everything is cranked up a notch. We find that relationships can't stand the strain of this relativism. You know, it's okay if we marry, it's okay if we don't. It doesn't really change all that much. And so our relationships, our marital relationships, our friendships and everything else, they do not have the power that they once had. Their pressure in many areas, financial pressures. What they predict is that there's going to be downward mobility. For the first time in current American history, they expect that the earnings of the children will not nearly reach the earnings of their parents. Both husband and wife work. But the money that the two bring in together is not as much as the money that one person would bring in the late 50s or even mid-60s. And so finances are a problem. The economical situation, nobody can even figure it out. The economists don't know how to control the money flow any longer. They don't understand their own profession any longer. Job security, insecurity. The big one, time. A time crunch. Time is the most valuable commodity that we've got. I read the other day where a person would spend $20 for someone to deliver them a package of hot dog buns because they didn't have time to go to the store. And so they hire people to do little things for them just because time is so precious. The problem of crime. Where we double lock our doors and worry about our kids out on the street. We wouldn't think of letting our kids go out and run around the way they did a generation ago. A decaying society, the omnipresent media, where we actually suffer a brainwashing effect on ourselves. And what happens is that life becomes chaotic for the family, and put so much pressure on the family that people start to fall apart. Now, this is what's happened since Max and I had that conversation out on the lawn out here 30 years ago. Now, we're just really getting started with the changes of this society. The information highway that we're beginning to hear about. That will change life again, just beyond belief. And I wonder, you know, 30 years from now, what's it going to be like? What kind of changes are you going to be living? What kind of pressures are you going to be living with? Max and I were talking just before this session, and it's always interesting to compare notes with old friends and find out, okay, how are you seeing it? How are you reading it? And he says, what we're running into more and more on campus is that people come really beat up. Life has really been tough for them. Families have been fragmented. And so kids are paying the price for the fragmentation that they grew up with. Now, we've got that, you know, that's kind of the bad news. Now let me show you a passage of scripture, Isaiah 61. Isaiah 61, if you have a Bible, take a look at this. Jesus read this passage. It's accounted in Luke chapter 4. He'd been out and had done some preaching and healed a few folk and came back to his hometown of Nazareth. And so he went to the synagogue that Saturday, and he took the scroll of the book of Isaiah and got up and he read this passage. And just his reading it was a statement to the fact that he was the Messiah. Because it's a messianic passage, and it refers, it was a prophecy of what the Messiah was coming to do. He read, "The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, and release for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Now that's about as much as Luke records. But we're going to go on and read a little bit further. But so often, the idea here that people get is that Jesus is sort of either a revolutionary where he's out for the downtrodden, or we politicize this, or we see him as someone who brings economic relief to the materially poor and so on. But he's dealing with something a lot bigger than that. And to give that kind of interpretation to this passage is to diminish the real power of the passage. What he's talking about is that a person without Christ is he is brokenhearted, is a captive, a prisoner, and is a broken person. And so often in our experience, what we see as we begin to get involved in the lives of people is that, hey, they're really broken. And so he goes on in this passage and says, verse 2, "To proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, and provide for those who grieve in Zion, to bestow on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning." Now imagine a person who comes broken, whose life has been shattered just by their background. And we look at them and we say, hey, there really isn't a whole lot of fixing for this person. Why don't we go on to someone who's a little bit easier? Well, what he says here is that Jesus' work is to go to the people who are broken beyond repair. And his work is to comfort those who mourn and to provide for those who grieve, to bestow on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, and a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. They will be called oaks of righteousness. Who will be called oaks of righteousness? Who? Look at the passage. Who will be called oaks of righteousness? Yeah. Those people that were too beat up to be able to do anything will be called oaks of righteousness. A planting of the Lord for the display of his splendor. They will rebuild the ancient ruins. Who will rebuild the ancient ruins? Those same people that were broken. And restore the places long devastated. They will renew the ruined cities. And so the basic claim that the Bible makes about the work that Jesus does is that he starts with people who are broken beyond repair. The kind of people that we have been describing here with these transparencies. He will take people like that. He will put them back together. And they will become oaks, people who are strong, who will provide shade for other people. And then those people will rebuild the cities, the ruined cities. Now that's what we've got in this country, isn't it? Ruined cities. So this is the claim that Christ makes. My job is to take the people who are really hopeless and make them something that you would not believe. Okay, so let me posture the question for us to discuss. The question is, if that is what Christ wants to do, what does this tell us about how we should carry on our lives and live our Christian lives in this world? What does this tell us about this? What does this tell us about helping other people, who we should help, and the way we should help them? Let's talk about that. What does this tell us? Yeah. Okay. Never thought we could do that, did we? Because we were so broken. Thought we would always be kind of a basket case, didn't we? But we're not going to be. Yeah. Okay. What else does it tell us? Yeah.
Maybe not to give up on those people that we see as being too broken and too down.
Yeah.
So we can possibly help them, but just not to give up on them.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Everybody hear that? Don't give up on them. What else? What else does this tell us about the way we should live life, the way we should view ourselves? Yeah. Okay. I think we can do that. Make that kind of a transfer. Because it says in 2 Corinthians 5, he has committed unto us the word of reconciliation. Right? Okay, that's good. What else does this tell us? Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's good. Yeah. What else does it tell us? Well, let me push it a little bit further. One of the things that I think that we Christians many times do not realize is that the church is in the world for the sake of the lost. We're in the world for the sake of the lost. Now, it's not the only reason that we're there, but we're in the world for the sake of the lost. It's the theme of the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. When man fell, God set out and looked for Adam and Eve in the garden. And he's been looking for man ever since. And the refrain of the Old Testament is, "Then you will know that I am the Lord. As I do this and as I do that, as I do this and as I do that, then you will know that I am the Lord." And so as we read the Bible, what we see is that God is pursuing man and women. And he is setting out to establish the fact that he is the Lord to deliver them from what they are into. When Jesus came, what did he say? "The Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." And so the whole purpose of his coming was for the sake of a lost world. And when it comes to us, we already talked about this passage. There are many passages, but he has committed unto us the word of reconciliation. And so one of the things that we have got to come to grips with as God's people in this society is that we're not here just for our own selves, but we're here for the sake of the lost. Now, that brings tension. Because the world is kind of a dangerous place. And we think, well, aren't we supposed to come out from among them and be separate? What does the Bible say about that? But the problem is that we are in the world because of the lost, and we cannot avoid that. I was in a conference in June with a group of people that came together and wanted to talk about Church Without Walls. And so we had kind of a conference without walls where we just kind of did whatever came next for a week. And at one point had the group divide up and sit around tables for mealtime and ask them to talk about their unbelieving friends and what they could do to reach their unbelieving friends. Well, one table, group of Christians, not a one of them had an unbelieving friend. Well, now, in fact, it was part of their convictions that they shouldn't have unbelieving friends. And we are taught that many times. And the fact is that when we are taught that, we are really led in the opposite direction of where we should be going when it comes to our relationship with the world. Look at Matthew chapter 13. Starting with verse 24. Jesus told them another parable. "The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while everyone was sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. When the wheat sprouted and formed heads, then the weeds also appeared. The owner's servants came to him and said, 'Sir, didn't you sow good seed in your field? Why then did the weeds come? Where then did the weeds come from?' 'An enemy did this,' he replied. The servants asked him, 'Do you want us to go and pull them up?' 'No,' he answered, 'because while you are pulling up the weeds, you may root up the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. At that time, I will tell the harvesters, first collect the weeds and then tie in bundles to be burned, and then gather the wheat and bring it into my barn.'" And so Jesus told this little story, and most of the people left after hearing the story, and you could hear him walking away, and one guy says, "Gosh, that guy really knows a lot about farming, doesn't he?" And that was about all he got out of that discussion. But there were some of those people in that crowd knew that Jesus was doing more than talking about growing wheat. And so in verse 36 it says, "He left the crowd and went into the house. His disciples came to him and said, 'Explain to us the parable of the weeds in the field.'" So he says, we know that there's more to this than this little story that you told. And now look at the plain answer he gives. And when you ask him a straight question, he'll give you a straight answer. He answered, "The one who sowed the good seed is the Son of Man." So he's talking about himself. "I'm the one who sowed. The field is the world. The good seed stands for the sons of the kingdom. That's us. The weeds are the sons of the evil one. And the enemy who sows them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the harvesters are angels. So, it couldn't be more clear. Now the question. We who are sons of sons of the kingdom, where do we belong? According to this passage. Where? In the field. Right alongside of the sons of the evil one. Now, so often we've been taught that the place where we really belong is in church. And we define success by seeing how much seed we've got in the bag. And if the bag weighs more this year than it did the year before, then we're really successful. How many have you got in your youth group? How many have you got in this? Or how many have you got in that? Success is being in the world right alongside the sons of the evil one. That's where we belong. Now, you know, this time of the year, it's been snowing the last couple of days, and I've been able to kind of forget about it. But I you know, gardening is kind of my one touch with reality. I mean, you can be so busy and be going about so much that you never have a chance to stop and, you know, realize that you're a part of this ecosystem that we live in. So I like to, you know, plant flowers. I like to mow my lawn and stuff like that. So about this time of the year, I head for the seed stores. And, you know, these racks that turn around and you've got the, you know, all these envelopes on there with the, you know, the flowers and the vegetables, you know, with carrots that long and stuff like that. And you pick up those packages and think, boy, I'd like to have that in my yard. So I always buy some of those. And I always kind of feel sorry for those packages that I buy because they're doomed. But I got my little plot of ground all, you know, cleared off, and I'm waiting for the snow to leave and the frost to get out of here, and then I'll plant them. But you know, when you open up one of those bags and you look in, and what do you see? These little black specks, you know, and you think, gosh, I mean, I paid good money for that. And then you go ahead and you do it. You put the seeds in the ground, and you can't see them anymore. They just vanish. So you kind of rake over it, and the bag is empty, so you throw that away, and you've taken a risk. And, you know, then I travel during the summer, and everything goes to weeds. And so, you know, in my case, it really is lost. But being sown in the world is risky. But it is where we belong. Jesus said, I know that it's risky. That's why in John 17, I have prayed for them. I have sanctified myself. I've set myself apart for them so that they may be kept. But we're in the world not just to be there alongside the sons of the evil one. We're in the world to germinate. And in John chapter 12, let's take a look at that. In John chapter 12, he carries the metaphor a little bit further. Verse 23. Jesus said, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. I tell you the truth. Unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. So he's talking about himself here. And he's saying, if I don't fall into the ground and die, I'll be eternally by myself. But he did die, didn't he? And because of that, there are many seeds right here. And throughout history, millions of seeds as a result of that one death. Then he turns it around and he puts it on us. He says, the man who loves his life will lose it, while the man who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. Whoever serves me must follow me, and where I am, my servant also will be. And so what he's saying is, if you want to save your life, in other words, you want to live it for yourself, you're going to end up a lonely person. But if you give your life for other people, you will multiply, and you will be many seeds. You know, the refrain of the day is what? You owe it to yourself to achieve your full potential. It's one of the doctrines that have come out of modernity. Let me tell you something. That's a lie. If you are into that one, if you're out to achieve your full potential, and if that's what's driving you, you're going to end up empty. Jesus' words are just the opposite. As you give your life to other people, just as he gave his life for other people, you're going to find life. And it's just a reversal. It's one of those great reversals that you find in Scripture between what the world is telling us and what we what truth is, what Christ tells us. Let me establish one more point, then we'll take a break. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, let's take a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 7. The Christians at this time were under great pressure. And it's kind of a strange chapter because we have to understand the context in which it was written. Verse 26 says, because of the present crisis, I'm telling you these things. And Christians were under persecution. They were fleeing for their lives. But in the middle of it, he gives instructions for how people who are coming to Christ, and of course the people in Corinth were coming out of it was kind of the porno capital of the first century, and he was talking to people who really had a messed up background. He says, okay, this is how you deal with life. And he says, now some of you find yourselves in bad marriages. You're married to a person who's not a believer, and so you're thinking, well, maybe I ought to get out of this marriage because, after all, it's not very comfortable, and maybe I should find someone who is a believer or so on. And but in verse 15, he says, or let's skip down to verse 17. He says, nevertheless, each one of you should retain the place in life that the Lord assigned to him and to which God called him after discussing this problem of this bad marriage. He says, stay in it if you can. And retain the place in life that God assigned to you. And he says, when you come to Christ, you find yourself already in a situation, a set of relationships. He says, don't jump out of them. You're in this place, within this set of relationships, by God's design. Then he goes on and he talks about your identity. He says, was a man already circumcised when he was called? Circumcision was a mark of being a Jew. And he should not become uncircumcised. Was a man uncircumcised when he was called? He should not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing. Uncircumcision is nothing. Keeping God's commands is what counts. Then again he says the same thing. Look at this, verse 20. Each one should remain in the situation which he was in when God called him. So when God calls you into his family, what he's saying is you already have an identity. You already have a set of relationships. Don't tear those apart. Keep them intact. Then he goes on. He says, were you in a bad job? Were you a slave when you were called? Don't let it trouble you. But if you can get your freedom, go for it. For he who was a slave when he was called by the Lord is the Lord's freedman. But then he says in verse 24, Brothers, the third time he says the same thing. Each man, as responsible to God, should remain in the situation God called him to. I want to establish just a couple of points here. First of all, so many times when a person comes to Christ, their first thought is, well, I want to really seriously follow Christ, okay? And what's the first thought that comes to their mind? How do I do that? Go to seminary. Or become a missionary. Or something like that. Well, that's not what this passage says, is it? It says that the circle that you're in, the place that you're in when God called you, that's the place of your calling. I call this person the insider. Every one of you in this room, you're insiders. See, every one of you in this room, you have a set of relationships that is uniquely yours. And nobody else has that same set of relationships that you have in quite the same way. Now, what I understand from this passage and other passages is that you are where you are by God's design. And really be careful before you jump out of it to get into something else. There are a lot of people today who who think, well, I want to serve Christ. And so, you know, they're off to Russia. But they haven't learned how to even go across the hall in the dormitory. It's maybe easier to go to Russia than it is to go to your neighbor in the dormitory. And what we need to understand is that we are already strategically positioned. And your first calling as a follower of Christ is to be an insider in the world.